Hey there, future mama. Welcome to the Expert Nutritionist podcast. I'm Lacey Madden, fertility nutritionist, and this is the podcast for you if you're wanting to optimize your egg quality and fertility so that you can get pregnant and stay pregnant, or increase your IVF success if you're needing a little help from assisted reproductive technology. In these bite-sized episodes, I will be sharing with you easy-to-digest information and helpful tips and tricks to support you on your path to becoming a mama. Let's get into the episode. So in today's episode, I'm going to be chatting with clinical embryologist Victoria from All About Embryology, and we're going to be discussing all things eggs, embryos, and assisted reproductive technology. Victoria has over 15 years of experience and is now using this experience to give her patients independent embryology advice and support. So welcome to the podcast, Victoria.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
So excited to chat with you. Can you tell the listeners just a little bit about yourself, where you're based, and how you became an embryologist?
Yeah, no, of course. So I've been an embryologist, as you said, for over 15 years now. So I started out my journey in London, and I've worked my way sort of up the sort of senior levels. And then my latest job, I moved out to Surrey in London, just outside of London. And then I got the role of lab manager there. So I was in that role for about 4 years. And I just started to spend a lot more time with my patients. It was a smaller clinic, unlike the big London ones. And I just realized that there was a bit of a gap in the patient's understanding. So they get a lot of help from the doctor's side, where they're talking about the causes of the infertility and what the treatment's going to actually mean in terms of stimulation and everything. But then suddenly they're thrown onto the lab side and they don't really have a great deal of understanding. And, you know, you hit the point of egg collection and, you know, you're then the main point of contact is going to be your embryologist. And if they don't understand all the terminology, exactly what to expect with fertilization or things like that, it can make it a very scary, daunting phase for the patients. On top of the fact that they're being pumped with hormones and, you know, there is a natural emotional side anyway. So that kind of led me to say, actually, I feel like I can really help patients by coming away from the clinical setting and actually being someone independent. So it doesn't matter where the patients are, which clinic they're at. I've done overseas patients, just to really be a bridging gap between what they're getting from their clinic and sort of themselves, so that they don't have to sort of go down that rabbit warren of the internet and trying to kind of ask for help online or ask family and friends who might have had a cycle themselves but be in a completely different situation. So I want to be able to, you know, give the patients independent advice and help them, you know, be able to ask the right questions to their clinic and really make sure that they're getting the right treatment for them and they're not being persuaded into doing anything that they don't necessarily need. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about add-ons and stuff at the moment. So that's what led me to set up All Our Embryology. So it's been just over a year now. I'm absolutely loving it. Hopefully I'm able to help lots more people in the future as well.
Amazing. The work that you do is so needed. So, yeah, on behalf of everyone that's benefiting from your services, thank you so much because, yeah, it's such important work that you do. So I want to cover and I guess pick your brain on three main topics in this episode: age, genetics, and environment, and I guess the impact that they have on egg and embryo quality and development. So to kick things off, do you mind explaining a little bit about the role that age plays when it comes to our egg quality?
Yeah, no, of course. So age is unfortunately one of the biggest factors, and it's something we can't get away from. Obviously, lots of patients that go down the IVF route will be older, and that's natural because they would have, you know, had a few years that they've tried naturally, and then they'll look to do IVF. And that's part of the reason why I want to also focus a lot of my time on educating younger people as well, so that they're not leaving it to the point where it might potentially be a bit too late. So what happens with age, obviously, with us women, we are born with a defined number of eggs. So at birth, we're born with about 1 to 2 million approximately. By the time we reach puberty, that's gone down to around 300,000. So you can see already there's been quite a big drop off. And then by the time that we get to, you know, the reproductive years, you know, they're saying that we might only ovulate a few hundred over that period. So the numbers obviously decrease hugely. And then obviously once your yolk number gets down really low, that means you're then starting to go down the menopause side of things. So because there's such a natural decline, we're looking at a drop off in quantity, which is the first thing. So that's what people talk about, the ovarian reserve. So the lower the ovarian reserve, obviously the reduced chance of conception. But on the other side is the quality. And so it's not just about the quantity of the numbers, it's about the quality. And we do see a decline with age with that as well. So there's two different ways we can look at it. There's the quality in terms of the genetics. So that's your chromosomes. And as women get older, after about 35 especially, we start seeing an increase in an abnormal number of chromosomes within the egg. So that's one side that will decline. And the other side is the sort of cytoplasmic side. So all of the stuff that goes on within the egg, aside from the DNA, and you get an increase in abnormalities. So you get more dysmorphic eggs as you get older. So, and obviously they have a reduced chance of maybe fertilizing or forming a good quality embryo. So unfortunately, those three parameters do decrease with age, which is why obviously the chances of conception will go down as the lady gets older.
Yeah. If only we could rewind that clock, wouldn't that be amazing? You touched a little bit.
I mean, absolutely. It's just one of those things. And I think a lot of it stems down to education. You know, in schools, we're taught about how not to get pregnant, and you know, the sex education side of it, which obviously is incredibly important. But we're not taught anything about fertility, and we're not taught anything about why things might not happen naturally and what to look out for and what you can do and what the options are. So, for instance, with egg freezing, it's sort of taken off hugely. But the people that are freezing their eggs are their late 30s who are starting to panic a bit that maybe they're not in the right situation to have children yet. But really, you want to be catching the people in their 20s. To freeze their eggs. So things like that, it's all an education. And obviously the more people like myself that are sort of out there trying to do stuff, especially online, you know, I've even ventured onto TikTok, which was incredibly scary to do. But, you know, I'm trying to kind of capture people, you know, at the earliest stage as well, so that it's not necessarily people in a situation where they have left it to the point that it might be a little bit too late.
Yeah, it's a very important message that you're sharing. And, yeah, hopefully it's something that will become more well-known and, I guess, less overwhelming and daunting for women before they get to that stage where, oh, no, is it too late for me? Have I left it too long?
And also to realise other patients are a lot. So people are also going through the same thing. It's not just them as well.
Yeah.
Get away from this awful taboo that is still around fertility.
Yeah. The more we talk about it, the more it's going to ease the burden on those women who feel so isolated. So you touched a little bit about genetics. You know, there is a saying in the medical field that it's often the genetics that loads the gun, but it's the environment that pulls the trigger. Can you talk to us a little bit about how environment plays a role in egg quality?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's something that is a very fast-growing field now. So, you know, 10 years ago, you know, if you were in the lab or the doctors, we would just say, nothing you can do about it. You know, what will be, will be. And obviously, in some respects, that can be true. In terms of, you know, you can't reverse an aneuploid egg. Mm-hmm. However, having said that, we are learning a lot more about supporting the eggs as they develop. And it is becoming a fast-growing field for what the advice should be for patients to optimize themselves before they go through treatment or before they start their fertility journey. You know, things like focusing on their diet, making sure, you know, they stop smoking, reducing alcohol, getting good sleep, taking the right supplements, you know, making sure they've got all of the right levels of, you know, their vitamin D, their folate, their, you know, zinc, all of these things to make sure they're at the right level plane before they start. And, you know, that we're really starting to learn a lot more about how this can support not only the eggs and the eggs quality, but also the uterine environment and sort of getting the patient in the right place to be able to, you know, have a pregnancy that's successful. So I think the way you describe it is absolutely spot on. You know, it is a big factor in the journey for these people.
Yeah, and I do have a lot of women say to me that their doctor is telling them that they don't have any control of their egg quality. And it makes me really sad because there are things that are within their control that they can do that can have a positive impact on their egg quality. So what would you say to that as an embryologist?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, we're learning a lot more. And, you know, some of the doctors may well, you know, be very stuck in their ways from what they first learned. And whilst I see a lot of stuff online that I don't necessarily agree with, where people can say, you know, you can completely reverse infertility and you can, you know, have a pregnant natural, you don't have to have IVF if you do X, Y, and Z. That isn't necessarily true. And I think sometimes it can give a lot of misinformation to patients. But having said that, I do very much believe that a patient should be in the right place before they come for treatment. So for instance, a big thing, so I know this is flipping away from the females, but it's the same principle. We're doing a lot more testing on men with DNA fragmentation levels. So this is historically the man would just have a very quick semen analysis and that would be done. And if it was fine, it was clearly the woman's fault. Now we're starting to look in a little bit more about actually what's going on inside the sperm and the DNA and the fragmentation levels and stuff. So we're testing a lot of patients. And if the levels come back high, what a lot of doctors are saying is they're saying, we'll just do ICSI instead of doing IVF. Now that's the general treatment. Whereas for me, I think, well, actually what we should be doing is we should be trying to rectify why the DNA fragmentation levels are high. Mm. And obviously, especially with men, you know, they produce new sperm every 3 months.
So I know, lucky them, right?
Exactly. You can actually have a, you know, course of treatment that means they can almost kind of try and reduce that level before to get them in the right, you know, playing field to start the treatment. Now, on the flip side, if the female is older, obviously, you've got to weigh up. You don't want to leave her waiting too long because obviously then you get the age-related decline versus making sure the man's optimized. But it all goes back to sort of not leaving it to the point that it's too late, that we need to be focusing all of this well before we should be starting conceiving. You know, people might say they want to, you know, try for a baby when they're early 30s, but then maybe we need to rethink that actually, you know, in your late 20s, before you turn 30, you want to be getting all of this right, maybe doing the checks to see where you're at, and taking the right supplements and just looking after ourselves a bit more so that then when we do want to try for a baby, we're not sort of having to go backwards a bit with trying to correct some things.
Yeah. So what would you say would be the ideal time frame at a minimum that we should be allowing to prepare ourselves for assisted reproductive technology?
I mean, there's no specific answer. I mean, I would say you'd hope that the people before they came to come to the clinic would be trying for around a year on average. We see, obviously, it's slightly less as patients get older. You know, they're recommended maybe after about 6 months to look into it if they're sort of nearing the 40s. But I would certainly say that when people are trying, you know, if things aren't necessarily happening, they want to be looking at these kind of things at that point. They don't want to keep trying for the year, then go to the fertility clinic, have all the checks done, and then realize that actually they could have been doing some stuff on their own before, you know, looking at advice from people like yourself to sort of how to optimize everything beforehand. So, yeah, I certainly would say, you know, in the 6 months before they came for treatment, it would be great if, you know, people were doing the right things at that point.
Really quickly, wanted to let you know that I have a free resource for you. It's my egg quality boosting starter kit, and I know that you want to get your hands on it. So you'll find the link to it in the show notes. So when I knew that I was going to be interviewing you, Victoria, I was so excited and I asked my audience what they would like me to ask you. So they'd sent me through some questions. And the first one is, what is your best advice to mentally prepare for the IVF journey?
Okay. That is, you know, quite a loaded question because there's lots that people can do to prepare. I would say personally, the biggest thing is to equip yourself with knowledge. I've said it so many times before, but knowledge is power. if you go into a clinic and you don't have that information behind you, you can be left quite vulnerable. And obviously, I can only vouch for the clinics that I work with, and I absolutely trust all of them. But there are going to be clinics out there that might try and, you know, push you for things you don't need and convince you on things that you come away from and you think, actually, did I need this? Was this right for me? But if you don't have that knowledge in advance, you're going to put yourself in a bit of a vulnerable situation. The next thing I would say is you've got to protect your mental health. Going through fertility treatment is tough. It's tough on two sides. It's tough physically and it's tough mentally. Obviously, you're putting your body through quite a lot, especially during the stimulation part. You know, there's quite a lot of side effects that patients can feel. And then you're having medical procedures as well. So it's tough physically on your body. But emotionally, the journey is a huge roller coaster. So you want to get yourself in a position that you have support around you. You know, as I said before, I mean, I'm desperate for this fertility taboo to go away. I want people to be talking. If, you know, you're going through something really difficult, you want the people around you that you would normally chat to about things. But I've even had really close friends of mine, and they know I'm an embryologist. And they still haven't talked to me about, you know, that going through for treatment. They've kept it to themselves. And it's a really difficult one because you want to make sure that people don't feel isolated and alone. Whether they talk to a stranger or whether they talk to, you know, their family, you know, it's completely individual for that person. But just making sure that they're not getting overwhelmed and getting themselves kind of caught up in feeling quite kind of isolated by it all. They'd probably be the main things I would say, and just look after yourself and take care of yourself and don't be hard on yourself, because it's okay to cry in an appointment. It's okay to call back and ask for clarification on something. All these things, you've got to do what's right for you in this journey to make it better.
Yeah, I love that. You know, no question is a silly question, and you're your biggest advocate, and it's definitely not for the faint-hearted. And I love that you made a strong point about forming a support network, because yeah, it will make all the difference. Next question is, what's the difference between the different embryo gradings? This was a common question that came through, and which one has the better chance of success?
Okay, so we grade differently depending on what stage the embryo is at. So in the early stages, so between about day two and day three, what we're looking for is we're counting the number of cells. So this shows us the rate of division. So we have a specific rate that we want to see. So you don't want them dividing too quickly. And likewise, if they're slow, they might be sort of falling behind a bit. So that's the first thing we look for. The second thing we look for at this cleavage stage is the quality. So we're looking for the level of fragmentation. So when a cell divides into two, you want to get a nice, clean, even division. What can sometimes happen is little bits of the cells can break away, and then those little bits stay in the space, and they're called fragments. So the more fragments we have, the higher the level of fragmentation. So that will then reduce the quality. And we also look at things like, you know, if the cells are looking quite granular, and as I said, the evenness of the cells. So based on those parameters, we give the embryo a grade. So it's got a cell number and it's got a grade. And obviously, the higher the grade, the better the quality. Now, different clinics will use a different system. So some, for instance, use numbers 1 to 4. But I've worked in two clinics out of my three, and one had 4 as their top and one had 1 as their top. So it can be quite confusing for patients. So I tend to, when I speak to my patients, just say, top quality, good quality, average quality, poor quality. Because I think it makes it, you know, if you spurt too many numbers at the patients, it just confuses them. So that's how I generally describe it to patients. Then what happens is when the embryo starts to grow to the blastocyst stage, we only see about 50% of them growing to that point. And that's completely normal, what we'd expect to see. But the ones that form blastocysts, we look at 3 different parameters for their grading. So we look at the level of expansion. So what happens with the blast is it takes fluid in and then it starts to grow. So the level of expansion shows how advanced it is. So that's the first thing we look at. The second thing we look at is the tight ball of cells, which is called the inner cell mass. Now, that's what goes on and forms the baby. So we want to see a good number of cells and then to be very compact to get a good grade. And the last thing is the cells around the outside called the trophectoderm. Now they go on to form things like the amniotic sac, the placenta, all of the extra embryonic material. And for that, we want a good grading to see nice, even, clear cells with a sort of even pattern and a good cell number at that point. Now, obviously, whether it's at the cleavage stage or whether it's at the blastocyst stage, the higher the quality grade, obviously, the more likely it is to implant. Having said that, once you get to the blastocyst stage, the fact that it's formed a blastocyst is quite a strong indicator that it has potential to go on. So certainly, I tell my patients not to get too focused on, you know, is it an AA or is it a BB or, you know, which one? You're not going to get too much of a difference in implantation between that. Obviously, if you've got an AA versus a CC, then you might get a bit of difference. But yeah, it's a guide mainly for the embryologist to just help us in the selection process. But it's really something that if you've got a good quality blastocyst, you know, you then hopefully stand a good chance of pregnancy.
Yeah, and always just a good idea to chat with your embryologist and your specialist team to understand what your individual circumstances are, because everyone's going to be different. It's going to mean different things to different people. Yeah. So the next question is, how can you help to support egg maturity?
Well, I guess that goes back to what we were talking about really with sort of the environment side. When you're going through an IVF treatment, the doctor will be externally, by your medication, controlling your follicles' development and therefore the eggs within them. So as the follicles grow, obviously the eggs develop and then they go on and mature. So that part is the doctor's responsibility when you're actually having treatment. Obviously you want to make sure that the doctor is checking you at least every 2 to 3 days, monitoring your stimulation dose. So sometimes it might be if the follicles aren't growing as well, then there might be a risk that the eggs aren't maturing as well. So they maybe tweak the dose. But on top of that, what the patient can be doing is exactly what we were saying before. So everything that they can to support that egg's development, making sure that they're taking, you know, a good number of supplements, making sure that they're looking after their health, they're getting good sleep, they're, you know, making stress levels down as much as they possibly can. Obviously, we all know that it's a very stressful procedure to go through. But if they can try and do anything that will relax them, so anything, you know, even if it's something that they know, you know, helps them, like acupuncture or anything, you know, all these things you can do to keep your stress levels down. And that in turn will help those eggs and give them the best chance to go on and grow nicely.
Yeah. And the next question is, why does the pre-implantation testing take so long? What's involved in this process? I can imagine there's a lot of anxiety when they're waiting, you know, when patients are waiting for these results to come through. So can you talk to us a little bit about what goes on behind the scenes?
Yeah, no, of course. So to do the genetic testing, what we have to do is, first of all, we have to grow the embryos to the blastocyst stage. So that's already 5 days down the line from when you've had your egg collection, sometimes 6 days. Growing to that point, and then in the lab, so where you've had your treatment, the lab will do a biopsy. So we'll take a small clump of cells away from the, do you remember I said about the outer shells, outer cells on the outside of the blastocyst. We take a small clump of those away and we put them into this tiny little tube, and that tube then gets sent off to a separate genetics lab. So it gets transported, depending on where the clinic is, to the lab that they work with. When it's received in the lab, they have to do a number of different things to be able to do their testing. Obviously, different labs do different methods of testing, but generally speaking, they amplify up all the DNA and then they run it through sequencing machines to then be able to look at all 23 pairs of chromosomes. So that's something that then needs to be analysed by the team. Then the report needs to be made. Then the report needs to come back to the clinic to be checked on. Some clinics will then have a genetic counsellor that then has to review it, especially if you're looking at things like mosaic embryos and things that might be a bit more grey area than abnormal and normal. And obviously, then the results can then come back to the patient. But then, because the embryos have been frozen in that meantime, the patient then has to then get set up and ready for a frozen thaw cycle. So you've then also got that period of time before they can then use those embryos, because it all depends on when the patient's naturally in their cycle. So it is a longer process, but it's something that, you know, that's how, and depending on the staff loads at the genetics lab, some of them might have to freeze some samples when they arrive to then run them, you know, the machines, because these machines are very expensive and, you know, time consuming as well. So it's something that, you know, they're going to have their systems depending on how many samples they're receiving. So yeah, the clinic will be able to quote the patient before, and they should be able to say, we will expect them at this point. But yeah, we do understand it is quite a scary time to be waiting for the patients.
How lucky are we though to be in a time that we can do something like this that can, you know, improve hopefully the chances of someone bringing a baby home? It's, yeah, pretty amazing stuff. Yeah, so the next question is, what can be done in preparation for an embryo transfer to increase the chances of it sticking?
So there's, you know, it obviously, short of what we've just been mentioning, there's not a huge amount that the patients themselves can do. The general advice that we say is, after the embryo transfer, you want to try and reduce anything that's going to cause any uterine contractions. Now, what patients sometimes worry about is that as soon as they stand up and go and empty their bladder, that the embryo is going to drop out. Now, it won't, because first of all, our uterus is, depending on, some people have a forward tilting, some people have a backward tilting, but it's not on a direct angle, and it's got lots and lots of sort of little inlet bits. So it's not just a big hole that people seem to sort of imagine it is. They're very, very close together and little inlets. So what happens is, after the transfer, the embryo is released in a very, very small amount of media, but it will just go and nuzzle itself in. It doesn't try and implant straight away. Usually you're looking at around day 8 to 10. But what we would say to the patients is, in that between time from their transfer to when the implantation would have hopefully have already successfully happened, to do nothing like sort of any heavy lifting, pushing, pulling, anything that, you know, is going to be causing those contractions in the uterus. And then, you know, some patients say, do I need bed rest? And you say, no, they can go about normal day-to-day life, but just being mindful that they don't want to, you know, to do anything that might kind of disrupt it. Because obviously, you know, when we're having, you know, period pain, menstrual cramps, that is a contraction. So, you know, anything that, you know, does that could potentially risk, because obviously for the period, you're pushing the blood down. So, you know, that's the job, to sort of empty it. So you don't want to do anything that's going to kind of cause those contractions. But short of that, just looking after yourself is the best thing that they can do. And, you know, getting good sleep and eating healthily and just trying to stay positive, as it's very difficult. And obviously different people have different coping strategies. Some prefer to just say that it's not going to work to protect themselves, whereas some people, you know, you want to feel positive and stuff. So do whatever is right for you. But yeah, I would try and encourage people to stay positive, you know, try and think good thoughts. And yeah, we'll keep everything crossed for them.
Yeah. And sorry, just on the avoiding anything that may encourage uterine contractions, would you say between that 8 to 10 days where implantation could happen is when you would want them to avoid doing those things?
Generally, yeah. But I mean, I would say probably from the time of transfer up until that stage. Obviously, if they've got, you know, we have some patients who have a toddler and they're coming for a sibling, and, you know, they're not going to not be able to pick up their toddler. So you've got to take it with a slight, you know, pinch of salt and not get obsessive about it. But it's just making patients be a bit more mindful to try and avoid it if they can.
Yeah. Yeah. And the final question.
Leave a hoover behind. No hoovering.
Yes. Leave it. Someone else can do it.
Exactly.
So the final question is, does follicle size matter?
Yes, it does. So follicle size gives an indication on how the egg is developing. And obviously you can't see, when the doctor is scanning and they're checking the follicle size, you can't actually see the egg within. you just see the follicle and all the follicular fluid. So the follicle will sit like this, and the egg will be in a sort of a connection, and then it will sit in the fluid. Now, as the follicular size increases, that's where you're starting to see then the changes in the egg, and then goes on to the maturity and the final maturation stage that you need to have a competent egg. And ideally, you want those follicles to be at least 14 millimeters before the trigger injection is given. Now, generally speaking, the doctors can't get all the follicles to be up at that point. Sometimes there will be some slow developing ones. And then they don't want to risk the faster developing ones to obviously get too big and risk ovulating. So it is a fine balance to get it right. But yes, certainly it does matter. You don't just want to, however, rely on the follicle size. You want to look at the estradiol level as well. So the estradiol level, when you're going through stimulation, it will increase as the follicle size increases. So approximately, you're looking at about 1,000 per egg. So you can then gauge whether that's going up nicely in sync with how the follicles are growing. You can then gauge that the eggs are doing what they're supposed to be doing and growing nicely. But yes, certainly it does matter when you're having a stimulation cycle.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much, Victoria, for coming on the podcast and having a chat with me. I have no doubt that the listeners have found this episode immensely helpful. So before we wrap up, can you please tell the listeners where they can find you?
Yes, so you can go to my website. So that's www.allaboutembryology.co.uk. Then I've also got my social media. So there's Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, which all have the handle at All About Embryology. And I've quite recently set up a YouTube channel as well. So I want to sort of have a channel that's all just sort of concentrated with the videos, all about education, and just having somewhere that people can turn to. So obviously you can click on that and subscribe to that, so you always get the updates of the new videos on there. And then obviously through my website, you can then book in for consultations. So I do the one-to-one consultations where I can look at exactly what's going on in your cycles, give you all the help and preparation, and obviously we can make plans going from there when I know all your details.
Oh, amazing. And I will put all of Victoria's links in the show notes. So go over and give her a follow. And if you know of anyone who would find this episode helpful, please share this with them. And thank you again, Victoria, and I'll catch you all in the next episode. If you know of a fellow future mama, please share this episode with her. And if you're loving the podcast, hit that follow or subscribe button so that you don't miss any new episodes. For now, I'm sending you lots of baby dust, and I'll catch you in the next episode.